They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. Wednesday's worse, and Thursday's also sad. Yes, the eagle flies on Friday, and Saturday I go out to play.
Stormy Monday Blues, T-Bone Walker. It's by way of introduction to our guest, Daniel Smith Christopher, a theologian with an interest in the blues and an insight into how they might be relevant in helping us understand what the Bible's all about. Daniel Smith Christopher, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I can't think of a more interesting conjunction, or for some people, I guess, a more paradoxical conjunction than the blues and the Bible. Just tell us why it's significant for you.
Well, the blues, of course, arises out of the tremendous suffering of African-American peoples immediately following slavery. So that's one of the interesting things to clarify, is that hardly anyone thinks that the blues came out of slavery itself. The blues comes out of the horrendous disappointment when the Civil War was supposed to end slavery. It was supposed to mean equality now for African Americans. And when it didn't, when the Jim Crow laws started to take over and when sharecropping as a system started taking over and held the African American under oppression almost as effectively as slavery, it's out of that tremendous sense of disappointment that there arises this musical form that has come to be known as the blues.
Because we associate black music on the religious side with gospel and out of gospel coming out of the spiritual.
Yes.
And the spiritual is there, but I take it that the blues in some ways comes out not of the spiritual but out of the work song, out of that.
Well, it gets very difficult to be precise about that. What we have is not much even oral history about the blues that goes much before the turn of the 19th century, 19th and 20th century. And we have spirituals, of course, that go back clear before the Civil War, because we know that some of the spirituals were being written down in the displacement camps immediately after the Civil War. They were already anonymous and already widely known among African American workers and among the people. But we don't have an oral history about the blues that arises much before 1900. That's when the stories begin to circulate as to who heard the first blues. And there's really three different oral traditions that get circulated by blues historians. One told by Jelly Roll Morton, who claims that the blues arose out of the famous red light district of New Orleans, Storyville. Another story comes out of Tutwiler, Mississippi, saying that the band leader W.C. Handy heard a young black musician playing the blues in the train station, which isn't there anymore, by the way. I was just there a couple months ago, and all that's there is just the concrete slab where the train station used to be and the tracks. And then there's a third story that comes from the blues diva Ma Rainey, who she says she heard a young woman sing the blues after one of her shows and started to incorporate it. What's interesting is that in all three of those famous oral stories about where the blues came from, supposedly, they all arose from anonymous sources, and they all arose from people in very desperate circumstances.
But the one thing the blues does have in common is a musicological origin. That is, it's basically a 12-bar form, and you've got a pentatonic scale, and there are certain sort of commonalities that allow you to track it down in some way, to tie it down in some way.
Yes. I mean, there's the standard AAB pattern that you'll always see. The first line is repeated, and then you have the famous blue note, which is in the third strophe for the third movement. You're right.
And the blues also is associated, as we use the word blues, with melancholy. There's always a strand in it of tragic melancholy, and it's not country and western-style tire style tragedy. It's deep. It's ongoing.
Yes, and it can be from a variety of circumstances. I mean, the most famous part of the blues tends to be about relationships breaking down, about the man missing his woman or the woman missing her man. But blues can also be about one's tragic circumstances. They can be about loneliness. They can be about poverty. And as a matter of fact, there's an awful lot of African-American culture and experience that often gets wrapped up in the lyrics of the blues. It's quite an interesting study just to look at the words themselves.
We've talked about the origins, the roots of the blues here, and I'd like to talk a little later about where the blues takes us into the future and even into contemporary music. But before we do that, let's talk a little about the Bible, because you actually, by professional training, are a theologian.
Yes, that's right.
So your starting point is traditionally the Bible. So what's the link here?
Well, I teach Old Testament studies at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. And while I am working in Old Testament work, my particular area of interest is in the tragic events that occurred about 600 years before the time of Jesus, when the Babylonian Empire, the famous Nebuchadnezzar, was at the head of the Babylonian Empire, and he conquered and devastated Jerusalem and the surrounding area around 587 BCE, or as I said, about 600 years before the time of Jesus. Out of that horrendous tragedy came a good deal of biblical literature, as a matter of fact. Some of the prophets came out of that time period, Jeremiah and Ezekiel being the two famous. But I must say, even though I specialize in that area for a long time, I have not really paid much attention to a little book of only five chapters called the Book of Lamentations. And the Book of Lamentations, by universal agreement, is a book whose poetry of sadness is in direct response to that horrendous destruction of Jerusalem. And as I finally turned to that material, it was about the same time that I was doing some thinking on the history of gospel music and realizing, now wait a minute, as I'm reading Lamentations, I'm thinking, now this is interesting. In fact, one could call the Book of Lamentations Hebrew blues. And one could certainly call the blues arising out of the African-American experience a kind of African-American lamentation. Well, once I made that connection, then I started paying much more attention to what happens when I'm thinking about listening to and reading both of those at the same time, going back and forth. And it's been a wonderful year of some discoveries and learning a great deal and, quite frankly, enjoying myself as well. Studying the blues means listening to an awful lot of good music.
It's essentially, in both instances, it's a story of dispossession.
Yes.
A dispossession. A cultural dispossession.
Yes, and a great deal of shock as well. I mean, one of the reasons why I think it's important to note that the blues came out of the great disappointment after all this promise that this war was finally going to free these people is that that's kind of the equivalent in some ways to the Hebrew shock that their city, I mean, the city of God, was conquered. And you've got these prophets like Jeremiah basically going around saying, yeah, and God allowed it to happen, which was a shocking message. And so there's this sense of as you say, a displacement, sense of shock, sense that the world just isn't making sense like it's supposed to.
That the world indeed is crazy, turned upside down, which is a theme in much of blues music. Let's turn to that. We started with Stormy Monday Blues by T-Bone Walker, and you've suggested a good follow-up to that is one that identifies the word crazy. Crazy Blues, Mamie Smith. Just tell us a little bit about why you selected these songs.
Well, Mamie Smith is important. We have to do honor to the First Lady of the Blues. Mamie Smith was the first recorded singer of blues music in history, and she was an unexpected success. The white record label owners were taking a chance on black musicians, and they were taking a chance on a form of music they weren't very familiar with. And they allowed Mamie Smith to record this song, and to their surprise, it was a big hit. So I think it's anytime we talk about the blues, we have to sort of, in passing, pay our respects to Mamie Smith.
Because she was followed by another Smith, Bessie.
Oh, yes.
Smith seems to be a common surname around that.
That's right. Well, Bessie Smith needs to be honored because in the 20s she had – I mean, this was before counts were still maintained, and this is long before there were hit lists and so forth. But had there been one, Bessie Smith surely would have had the top-selling record in America. She sold over 2 million copies of her famous recording in the 20s, and she became one of the great superstars of the early 20s. It's interesting that the first blues musicians were all women, the first famous ones. Mamie Smith, Bessie Smith, and, of course, Ma Rainey. Yeah. Now, Ma Rainey is going to connect directly to gospel because of the piano player she had, who was a young pianist by the name of Georgia Tom. Now, Georgia Tom would go on to change church history in the United States. He became the Reverend Thomas Andrew Dorsey, essentially the father of gospel music.
Yes, the father of white crossover gospel music. Because so many of those white musicians who began to write sort of country gospel write it in his sort of almost his,
oh, yeah,
his idiom,
well,
don't they?
Well, Thomas Dorsey was a brilliant, brilliant musician. And for a number of, particularly my white students at the university in Los Angeles, when I teach on this, they're surprised, even some of my black students, they're surprised to hear that gospel music hasn't, you know, always and forever been a part of African-American religious expression. And the fact is, it has not. I mean, it was Thomas Dorsey that introduced it. And it was incredibly controversial when he introduced it.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's
sure.
Let's have a little listen to Mamie Smith and then perhaps come back and pick up the strands of Thomas A. Dorsey. Crazy Blues, Mamie Smith, on Sunday night. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest is Daniel L. Smith Christopher, a theologian with an interest in music. Theology and music directed through the tradition of the blues, and we've just heard Mamie Smith.
The first recorded blues record, right? Mamie Smith.
That's an extraordinary thing to think that we've still got it sitting there available to all of us. And, of course, with the restoration available today, that's a whole other thing to talk about, where these things are actually recovering life for us in a way that they haven't been able to for a very long time. But you mentioned Thomas A. Dorsey, and we were beginning off a sidetrack there, because that's where, for many, many people growing up in churches, the hymn changes into the gospel song. And it's through Thomas Dorsey, and his influence was quite immense. I mean, we get hymnody moving in that direction with songs like The Old Rugged Cross and a few of those, but he introduces that sort of black element, and all of a sudden you have popular gospel song.
Well, we move from the spirituals that were very pious songs. They were often made up on the spot. Virtually all of the most famous spirituals are entirely anonymous. We have no idea who originally wrote them or coined them, as it were. They arose probably out of the preaching that was heard in the black churches by slaves. And they represent a kind of important alternative tradition, because the spirituals represent often African Americans rejecting what they were hearing from white preachers and rejecting what they were hearing from established churches, which were essentially, look, slavery's okay, you should work hard, you should accept your circumstances. And the spirituals represent an alternative to that. The spirituals represent a kind of Christian resistance movement in many ways. And so the spirituals talk about the time when God will liberate us. And there's an interesting double entendre that's is suggested in a song like Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Some people say, well, it just means that when they die, they'll go to heaven. But on the other hand, there's important double meanings there. Swing Low, Sweet Chariot might also refer to liberation and freedom in this life as well.
Mm-hmm. And
Steal Away to Jesus was the famous song that meant we're going to escape tonight. And so there's a lot of interesting social resistance going on in spirituals. And the part that I'm also interested in is that there's an awful lot of biblical interpretation going on in the spirituals as well.
Yes, the spirituals are theological exegesis in their own right.
That is, well, that, yeah. Yeah, that. I mean, take a song like, for example, Mary, don't you weep, don't you moan. And the next line is, Pharaoh's armies drowned in the sea. Mary, don't you weep, don't you moan. And I
yes, you're leaping several thousand years of biblical
yes,
history.
Yes, right. And I'm presenting that to my students, and I'm asking them, now, I want you to think about this. When would you be telling Mary not to weep and not to moan? Eventually they figure out, well, Jesus has to be on the cross now, and Mary's weeping. And so the song says, Mary, remember the power of God. Remember that Pharaoh and his armies were wiped away by the sea. Surely God can intervene in this circumstance as well. And then they sort of all eyes open bigger, and they suddenly say, oh, that's actually a very powerful song. And it's a very creative combination of scriptures.
And, of course, that creative power was taken up not just by blacks in during the period of Reconstruction, but then in the civil rights movement, and then,
yes,
of course, into South Africa. That same story of Pharaoh's army being drowned and is taken up by the blacks in South Africa in their great struggle against apartheid.
It's been said that gospel provided the musical backdrop to the civil rights movement. Especially you can hear it with an old spiritual like We Shall Overcome, which became the theme song of the civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s. Absolutely.
So how does gospel through then move into the sort of broad churches? And we mentioned Thomas A. Dorsey. We're talking about the 1920s and 1930s here, and Dorsey's writing in the 1930s. What does he do?
Yes. Well, Thomas Dorsey, as I said, Thomas Dorsey was a brilliant, brilliant man. Not only was he a wonderful musician, but he was quite an entrepreneur as well. In a day when records were a dollar a pop, that's a lot to spend in those days for music. Thomas Dorsey printed up his music and sold it at 5 cents a sheet. And so Thomas Dorsey was spreading his music very quickly. And as it caught on, in other words, as he stopped getting famously thrown out of churches, his famous line, as we said, was, I've been thrown out of some of the best churches in America. So it's important to think of that line because he reminds us that this music was controversial at first. It was not widely accepted, but it slowly started to spread. And he even started a national convention so that people could come together from churches all over the country to learn his songs, learn gospel music. And lastly, Thomas Dorsey's great contribution is that he was, of course, the tutor of the greatest gospel singer of all time, Mahalia Jackson.
Would it be fair enough to say that Dorsey also has a role in taking gospel out of the black churches into the white churches?
He's a little early for that.
Right. Certainly his songs eventually migrate.
Yes. I would say that that's more a phenomenon in the 70s.
Right.
There's a Los Angeles-based musician by the name of Andre Crouch.
Yes.
And Andre Crouch was the key crossover musician. Andre Crouch started playing gospel-style music for largely white religious conventions. Billy Graham had him play occasionally. And I would say Andre Crouch really is the crossover
musician.
Yes,
you get that flourishing, a little brief moment in the 70s, don't you, when you get people like the Edwin Hawkins singers,
yes,
and Andre Crouch then later on.
Right.
That begin to bring that music across. But certainly Dorsey's songs are well known these days across all churches.
Oh, absolutely now. Yeah. And, of course, he wrote what is perhaps the greatest gospel song of all time, Precious Lord, which is
Elvis
hard.
Made a million out of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's hard to find an African-American Christian in the United States today that can't sing the whole thing through.
Let's go back to the blues. The blues, pain, theology, the way in which salvation is visited on the people, but ultimately through a path of pain. So many of those blues songs, though, aren't religious. I mean, to quote Jolly Roll Morton again, they're brothel songs.
Yes.
The blues has a pain associated with it. And let's take one of those. Shamika Copeland, you mentioned a song.
Oh, yeah.
Ghetto Child. Tell us about this.
Well, Shamika Copeland is one of our modern blues divas now. She's a wonderful musician. And I often use this particular tune after reading the first few verses of the Book of Lamentations. And one of the interesting things about the Book of Lamentations is that it presents Jerusalem as a suffering woman. And so after you have this imagery of Jerusalem, she is suffering. See how she is in pain in Lamentations. And then you have this very moving piece that Shamika Copeland's recorded called Ghetto Child, which focuses again on a female persona in contemporary circumstances of the still, unfortunately, very difficult circumstances of many African-American communities.
Ghetto Child, Shamika Copeland.
Little girl, standing on the corner, somebody, please, won't you lend a hand? I'm just the ghetto child in this so-called
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Daniel Smith Christopher is our guest. He's a theologian with an interest in the blues, or more than an interest, exploring the blues and what they can tell us biblically, theologically and culturally. Let's go back again to this biblical story and the way in which, with your students, Daniel, you're able to explore theologically and enrich what the Bible is telling us through an understanding of the blues. You've mentioned, yes, Lamentations.
Yes.
Where else can you take us on this journey? How else do you deploy this technique?
Well, I mean, with the Book of Lamentations, for example, when I was doing some background work on that, one of the great Old Testament scholars of the 20th century is kind of a hero of mine, his Professor Klaus Westermann, a German Old Testament scholar, and he wrote a very important book on Lamentations that was published in English in 1990. And in that book, he tries to address the question, why was the Book of Lamentations so carefully constructed? Now, here's why that's an interesting question. If this is poetry of pain and suffering, you'd expect it to be just this outburst of anguish that doesn't take the time to sort of arrange itself carefully. It just speaks. And yet, the Book of Lamentations shows very careful arrangement. The first three chapters of the five chapters, for example, are carefully arranged so that each sentence begins with the next consecutive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So it's like the first verse is A, the second verse is B, etc. And you're thinking, well, now, you know, so somebody has gone to all this trouble to arrange this. And the question is, why? And so one of the standard answers is, well, maybe it helps you to remember them if these are being memorized and sung. And then Professor Westermann makes this, what I thought initially was very strange suggestion. He says, well, maybe it's just because they enjoyed listening to it that way, or they enjoyed reading it that way. And my reaction was, enjoy? And I thought for a moment there, Professor Westermann was, you know, this was what a cruel attitude. I mean, how could you enjoy poetry that speaks of such anguished events and frankly, such suffering? How could that be enjoyable? And then I thought of the blues. I thought of the fact that here's this musical form that has burst out of the South of the United States in the early part of the 20th century and has literally gone around the world, has had tremendous influence, and yet it too was a music of great pain, often anguish, about human experience. And yet it's tremendously enjoyed. So I think I got a little insight into Professor Westermann's idea, and I think I agree with him now. I think perhaps you could actually say that perhaps there was an element of enjoying listening to this kind of poetry because you identify with it, because you remind yourself of the times when you have in fact felt that way, Or perhaps you're going through something right now that you so closely identify with. One of the most interesting things is to watch an audience in a blues concert and see how many people are nodding. You know, you don't get that very much in other kinds of music. And yet in a blues concert, people are nodding their heads like, yeah, I've been there. Or yeah, I'm feeling that right now. And there's this tremendous sense of, there's almost a kind of connection that people make with a blues performer. I think that's one of the reasons why B.B. King, for example, is such a beloved performer. People feel like, you know, it's like sitting down with your friend and bearing your soul. And I think that that's one of the most powerful parts of the blues, and I'm beginning to understand that it may be one of the most powerful parts of the poetry of sadness in the Bible as well, like Lamentations and like many of the Psalms of Lament, which have a very similar form.
It's almost like you've discovered an elephant in the room.
Yes.
That is, for so many years, biblical scholarship has concentrated on the accuracy of the translation, on the logic of the theology,
yes,
on the inherent structure, without going to the affective and the emotional, to actually how it communicates and how it resonates.
Well, yes. How is this the poetry of a real people going through and living real lives? Yeah, I agree with you. It's not something that I was particularly trained to look for in terms of biblical studies, but it's something that you do learn to listen for when you're willing to sort of read the Bible with, as Karl Barth used to say, read the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other, to be aware of life going on around you.
But the blues also connected with a whole generation. If you go back to, say, the 60s, in just that way, it was part of this rock and roll revolution,
yes,
particularly, strangely enough, in England.
I mean, yes.
You go to groups like the Beatles, but more particularly the Rolling Stones.
That's
and
right.
Their whole influence comes out of discovering the pain of the blues and applying it to sort of life in 60s England for a whole lot of people.
Oh, yeah. In fact, Bill Wyman from the Rolling Stones has constructed one of the best historical books on the blues. It's filled with pictures, filled with all kinds of information. I was really impressed with it. It was a very useful tool.
And one of the best, of course, that they quote, you've mentioned a list, but the one person you haven't mentioned yet is Muddy Waters.
Yes. There's a famous story about the influence of Muddy Waters on British rock and roll, and that is that when the Beatles first came to New York and they were interviewed by an American journalist who said, now, who have been your influences? And Paul McCartney almost instinctively said, Muddy Waters. And the American journalist replied, where's that? I mean, they weren't even aware of their own history. And so some people have said that what the initial so-called English invasion, the famous rock music of the Stones and the Beatles and others, some people said that what they essentially did was that they gave America back the music of the African Americans that they already were benefiting from.
Is that because that music of African Americans was trapped in the subculture?
That's part of it. I mean, it's interesting that in the United States, you seem to see waves of revival of blues music. And one of the most important revivals of blues that occurred was after the English invasion, as it were, the Beatles and the Stones, and or just before. And so in between one of those sort of rises on the graph that represents the sort of blues revivals, as you said, was when it was sort of transported to Europe, a little bit in France, but a good deal in England. And a number of important blues musicians made European tours and were very well received.
Well, we've got a little of Muddy Waters here. Garbage Man Blues. Just introduce it for us.
Yeah, this is a sort of both anguished but also kind of funny tune that Muddy Waters does. It talks about his wife running away with the garbage man. But it gets us into one of the most important parts of the controversy around the blues, particularly if you're going to work with it in the context of theology. And that is the blues has a very frank approach to life. It talks about sexuality. It talks about broken relationships. It talks about your woman or your man running off with somebody else. And that's what Garbage Man Blues is about. And it's fun to listen to his reaction to that.
Muddy Waters, Garbage Man Blues.
My baby, she run away with the garbage man. Yeah, my baby, she run away with the garbage man.
Music of Muddy Waters on Sunday night. A selection of our guest, Daniel L. Smith Christopher. Theologian and musicologist, I could guess you'd call
well,
yourself.
Well, that would aspiring? Be an insult to my that would be an insult to my colleagues in musicology. Blues enthusiast. budding blues enthusiast. There we go.
Muddy Waters is a good example of how truth strikes through this music, through humor and pain. It's also a really good example of the split between, say, gospel music and blues music, and,
yes,
if you like, the split between religion and culture.
Yes.
In that these days it's almost as though in the church you're not allowed to address truth in that way, so we have to formalize it. And in a sense, is that perhaps part of the reason why the church is having trouble connecting with a lot of people today, because that element of truth has been stripped out. It's been clarified, homogenized, cleansed, made appropriately soporific, really.
Yes, I think it's a very interesting insight. And the ability of the blues to deal very honestly with very human topics and sometimes get quite off color in doing so. I mean,
as does the Bible on occasion.
Well, certainly. I often remind my students that the blues doesn't get any more erotic than the Song of Solomon, that's for sure. And so we need to make sure that we understand that sexuality has its acceptable and good part of the human experience. And frankly, John Spencer, who's written a book called The Blues and Evil, which is a wonderful, wonderful book, John Spencer argues in that book that really, let's listen to what the blues lyricist really wants, with the exception of a few just really extreme songs that are just written more for bragging. Most of the time, particularly in the older blues lyrics, what is it that people want? Well, the man wants that woman to be with all the time. The woman wants that man and a stable life. I mean, what they want are very traditional values. And, you know, the early blues tunes, very few of them had the sort of I want to sleep around with anybody kind of things that are popular with young kids. That's not serious blues. In fact, the serious blues musicians lamented that they didn't have a stable life. They lamented that they didn't have a job that could keep them going. And there was real serious suffering and real serious wish for the way life is supposed to be. In some ways, there's actually some fairly conservative values being wished for in some of those lyrics of the blues. So it's important to see that this reputation that the blues got in the 40s and 50s, you know, the devil's music or evil music, well, that was only because they spoke very explicitly about wanting their woman or wanting their man. Well, that's something that Christians need to be realistic about as well. I mean, you know, we honor love. We honor intimacy. So we shouldn't exile blues to outside of the church. We should understand it. We should appreciate it. And we should understand that Lamentations is a part of our textual tradition as well.
Daniel Smith Christopher, our time is too short. It has just about run out. But you've taken us to a good place, because our final song, again, one you've pointed us to, is by Keb Moe, God's Trying to Get Your Attention.
Yeah, this is a good tune that reminds us that there is a strong religious strain of the blues, that it's definitely there. Keb Moe is a modern musician, He's still cranking out really good stuff, and I particularly like this particular tune.
Daniel Smith Christopher, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday night.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, you might be saved, you might be reborn, you might own a car with a big loud home. Maybe it's just news on your television, or it might be God trying to get your attention. Are you an engineer working on a farm, or a Casanova with a whole lot of charm? It might be a mouse living in your kitchen, or it might be God trying to get your attention. Well, it might sound bad, or it might sound good. Might be made of steel, or it might be made of wood. Maybe it's just news on your television, or it might be God trying to get your attention. Well, it might be in the church house, or it might be on the street. Somehow or another, every soul has got to be. Well, it might be in the city, or it might be in town. But one way or another, we're gonna find the higher ground. Well, you might be deaf, or you might be blind. She'll put the message right in your mind. Might look like a plan or a coalition, or it might be God trying to get your attention.
Listen to the wind, I listen to the mind, and then listen all over again. Well.